And good morning. It is 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna, and it is time once again for the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran, and a huge topic today, big topic. Been looking forward to doing a show about this for some time, and we've got a full studio this morning, and the topic is going to be cannabis and the new burgeoning cannabis industry here on the Kenai Peninsula. It's really taken off since the state of Alaska legalized marijuana a couple of years back, and so we'll just get right into it. And joining us in the studio, we'll just go right down the line. We've got Patricia Patterson. She owns High Bush Buds near Soldotna. Dolly Phelps is with us. She owns co-owns Peace Frog Botanicals up in Nikiski, and Leif Abel joining us as well, owner of Greatland Ganja down in Kisilov. And thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And so I want to get started. First thing we'll do is we'll get the phone number out. 690-1687 is the number if you'd like to get in on the conversation this morning. Again, 690-1687. And we have just wrapped up dip netting season. It's the big 3 weeks, and there's still plenty of tourists about. But Patricia, I was so happy that you were able to join us today as the owner of a retail establishment. Several retail establishments have popped up. A couple of new ones have just opened their doors. So very interested to talk about that. But I guess I have to imagine going over this last month or so, you've seen a lot of tourists come in from other places. And what's it like to walk folks through your store who maybe don't have a lot of experience with marijuana? They've never used cannabis before. I guess talk a little bit about what your experiences is with folks who are new to this culture that is now all of a sudden really out in the open.
Well, tour has been very fun because we're getting people from states that do not have legal marijuana. I mean, we're a lot of our tourists, Hawaii, Texas, the Carolinas, Florida, and we see people from Oklahoma and Tennessee, a lot of the southern states that you do not even see medical marijuana. So that's been more fun. A lot of tourism is coming in and just checking us out, not always purchases, seeing what it's like, seeing what a retail store is like. That's where they learn about the different types of strains and what they mean. And there's a lot of purchases just because you can. I don't have a lot of tourism coming in who do not want to purchase sometimes, purchase. But they're also traveling, and they only have a certain amount of time. So it's been more curiosity to see what it's like. But it's been so much fun because they just giggle.
What's the number one question that you get or that you hear from folks?
Probably the first question that we get is, what is the difference between an indica and a sativa? Because they've never really seen marijuana break down in the THC levels, the CBD levels, what type of strain it is. And so
let's talk about that. What are the differences? Because I'm going to guess that not all of our listeners know precisely what this stuff means either.
Well, in general, an indica is affects your body more, and a sativa is more in your head. So that's kind of our two ways we explain it. Our term for indica is in the couch. You want to sit. And sativa is more in your head. It's more of the do dishes and laundry and,
creativity.
It's that kind of difference. So it's been very, very fun. I will tell you the amusement we have with the people coming in. We had a Texas judge come in who says that he puts people in jail every day for marijuana, but it's legal. And he bought himself a marijuana cigarette.
Well, how about that? Well, if you're just joining us, it is the Kenai Conversation this morning here on KDLL. Joined in the studio this morning with Patricia Patterson. She owns High Bush Buds near Soldotna. Dolly Phelps is with us. She's the co-owner of Peace Frog Botanicals in Nikiski. And Leif Abel also in the studio with us this morning. He runs Greatland Ganja down in Kisilov. And just hearing that, we've got businesses now from near over by Soldotna to North Kenai down to Kisilov. And it's this new marijuana industry. I keep saying it's new, but for any of you, whoever wants to jump in, it's not like this is just yesterday. You've all been working on either getting your businesses started or being in business now for a very long time.
Several years, yeah. Yes. And it did start all with the interest in the industry. And as I learned more about it, I knew I had to learn all the regulations and study everything to really do it well. And boy, what a rabbit hole that's turned out to be. It's been quite the journey. I think we've educated a lot of people, a lot of our local government officials, and a lot of people in the community, just trying to hear those fears that they may have and find out where the root of that comes from. And more oftentimes than not, there's a reasonable answer to those that kind of helps mitigate that. So it's been positive, I think, overall.
And Leif Abel, I wanted to get to you. This is not your first time in the studio talking about this subject. We spoke a couple of years back as all this was just getting off the ground. And one of the things I remember talking about back then was the idea that sort of mindsets and attitudes about this were beginning to shift. And I'm curious if since businesses have gotten off the ground and it's become a bit more routine and people are going to stores and it's all really happening, how have you seen attitudes change? Are they changing? Are they changing more rapidly? Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, I think it's nice now that we've got about a year under our belts here on the Kenai Peninsula of having operating cannabis businesses. We've got several years of, you know, a legitimate legal adult use cannabis since the passage of ballot measure 2. And, you know, the proverbial sky hasn't fallen. We have, you know, zero reports of criminal incidences at any of the, to my knowledge anyway, at any of the marijuana establishments on the Kenai Peninsula. And there hasn't been a whole lot of negative fallout. To the contrary, I would argue that we've seen a lot of positivity. We can point to many of these things, whether they be, you know, a couple hundred jobs that are really nice to have on the Kenai Peninsula. And we should meet that number by January, hopefully. At this point, we have a little less than that, but there's quite a few. Between 20 and 30 something businesses between the ones that are operating and in the licensing phase. So these kind of numbers, show that obviously, you know, attitudes are changing. What the other thing that we notice that kind of indicates attitudes are changing, it seems to be a little bit less, we're hearing a little bit less opposition each time we go out. We're hearing a lot more intelligent questions from people instead of the more fear-based questions that we were being asked in the beginning. We all still spend a lot of time going out and talking to the community, especially with ballot measure 1 coming up, or Prop 1. So, you know, it's important that we continue the education. I do think that we have come a long ways, but we have a lot further to go.
Yeah, certainly. And the ballot proposition that will be on the borough ballot later this fall, we'll get to that a little bit later in the program because that's a huge topic sort of in and of itself. But talking about making the rounds around the community, Dolly, I know that you've been making the rounds about the community. And the economic impact is beginning to make itself known. Businesses have been operating long enough now, and you've got some numbers, and you've been...
I do.
Yeah, and I guess just can you give us kind of a snapshot of how things are going from a revenue standpoint, from a job standpoint?
Absolutely, absolutely. So what we've compiled here, and we did this by obviously accessing the information from the AMCO website on licensees, and then personally calling each of these facilities and asking them a specific set of questions in our survey. So currently we have 34 marijuana facility licenses, 23 operating, 11 soon to be operating. With those businesses, we've seen 86 new jobs with the expectation of an additional 58 this year. The total money spent on facility development and build out in the Kenai Peninsula borough is about $5.6 million. And this is everything from construction, IT, plumbing, land, electricians, all of these types of things, surveillance equipment, everything that's necessary and required by the state. So that was our initial, was 5.6. Our total monthly operating expenses for garden supplies, payroll, utilities, these sorts of things is about $3.8 million annually that these facilities will be spending here locally, which is a really good number, strong number. The monthly marijuana excise tax, which all cultivators need to pay $800 a pound to the State Department of Revenue, is expected to be about $2.8 million a year just from the KPB. And our estimated sales tax, which as we all know goes directly into our school system for the Kenai Peninsula Borough, is looking to expect to generate about $294,000 annually. And that could pay for a couple teachers or two.
Just a couple, and it's interesting. This is a topic in recent weeks we've had guests on the program and talking about economic development and this sort of idea that some industries are changing and that some of the sort of bedrock industries that we rely on here on the Kenai Peninsula and will for the foreseeable future, fishing, oil, those things are going to be around for a long, long time, but they're not necessarily as many jobs as they used to be or the same types of jobs that they used to be. And there are, of course, all the ups and downs that come with natural resource extraction and fishing and those sorts of things. This is a newer industry that seems to have a potential to be fairly level and not have the ups and downs, and there are other things attached to it. Things like tourism can be attached to it. And I'm curious, for you guys who are in the thick of it and having these discussions, I'm sure, with each other all the time and in your own businesses all the time, just what does the future look like? It's so early right now, but are the dreams bigger and bigger and bigger all the time? Or do you find that as you kind of wade into the waters that you're seeing roadblocks and it's hard to have those big ideas? Patricia?
Well, one of the things the Kenai Peninsula has is land ownership. We have a lot of families who own parcels of land, which make us a great opportunity for our cultivators. And the cultivators down here, which are the majority of the businesses that are on the license in the Kenai Peninsula, I mean, up to about 28 of them are all cultivators, are landowners and families. Many of our current cultivators are ex-oil fields. So just as you were saying, some of those jobs have been a bit insecure. They have moved over into something that they can make their land pay off. And that is an amazing thing to say to anybody down here, is that you can have own land, own your house, build a shop, and within the strict regulations, actually make money off your land and support your family. I think that's viable to our economy, because our cornerstone at the Kenai Peninsula, through all the peak years to the low years, have been the small business owner. And that's what this is an opportunity, is for a lot of small business ownership. And it keeps all the money down here in the peninsula as well. There's no fat cat in Texas paying, you know, counting their money. It's all here.
It's all local. But that also sort of precludes outside investment, and I know that that's maybe been an issue for some folks, and is coming up with capital. It's not cheap to get into this business. There's so much work that has to be done ahead of time. It takes time, it takes energy, it takes all sorts of things, and it takes a lot of money. And so do you feel like not being able to have some of that outside investment has hampered things? Or do you prefer that it's just sort of all or nothing? Leaf, you look like you've got an answer for this one.
I was smiling because this is probably the only issue that I can remember that I've really had mixed feelings on in the last several years concerning commercial marijuana in the state of Alaska. I think that for the small family business owner that Patricia was talking about earlier, which that's my family, I think overall it's probably a good thing that, you know, it's restricted. The licensing is restricted to people who qualify for a permanent fund dividend. My free market self in the beginning didn't think that was a good idea. I see, you know, an example that we can look at is Nevada. So Nevada, they opened it up. They wanted to try to bring in as much money as they could. They succeeded. They brought in a lot of money. I think most or, you know, a good portion of their businesses are owned by Canadian farms. And that's fine for them. I do love the idea that our businesses are Alaskan owned. I think that maybe in the future that needs to change a little bit. I think right now it was probably the right thing to do. I also know that, yes, it hinders the fundraising. I've spoken to numerous companies in the state of Alaska that were unable to raise as much funds as they thought they would be able to, and it was mostly because of the limitations.
Yeah, and it probably goes another way too, where they've raised some funds and they get into it and realize it's going to take more than we've got now, and we're pretty much tapped on being able to raise more. Yeah,
most people had to spend over twice what they expected.
Barriers to entry for sure in this industry, and that's something that I'm sure the conversations continue all the time. And you're hearing the Kenai conversation right now here on KDLL. We're speaking with Patricia Patterson. Patricia Patterson. It's a mouthful a little bit. She runs High Bush Buds over near Soldotna. Dolly Phelps is with us as well from Peace Frog Botanicals up in Nikiski. And we just heard from Leif Abel. He runs Greatland Ganja down in Kasiloft, talking about the new cannabis industry, or relatively new cannabis industry here on the Kenai Peninsula. And talking about this idea that as a new industry, it's something that you own your own land and you can have this product. That's something that is a little bit new. Well, I shouldn't say new. It's actually quite an old idea that one would be able to earn one's living off one's own land. But the idea that here we are in 2016 talking about small-scale farms and kind of living off the land. Dolly, you're relatively new to this. Leif, you've been at it for a while and even before Prop 2 a couple of years ago. But Dolly, what was talk a little bit about your experience in getting into this and transitioning from one career into this new industry.
Right. Well, that was quite the change. It's a life change. I was prior to this drywall contractor for 15 years with my husband. And so basically a construction worker. I got very interested in it. I switched gears, stepped out of the box, and started doing a lot of research and studying. We hadn't grown marijuana prior to, so it's all been a very quick learning curve for us. We seem to be doing well, putting out a good product. I think that's the hours of dedication and time of reading and learning about it. It's been quite the process, though, from participating with the regulatory process, some of the regulations that were major issues and obstacles right out the gate. We were able to get rid of a lot of those through a very strong public component that AMCO did offer to the public. So that's that really helped us get along the way. So for me, we started saving, started planning the business, got involved locally with the borough meetings, marijuana task force, and took it from there, I guess. Just took it from there, followed through. Made all the right decisions most of the time.
Most of the times, well, strikes and gutters, ups and downs, and yeah. It's a learning process all the way through. And I remember asking you this question before, Leif, that, you know, was it at the time when the ballot proposition was very near the vote or maybe it had just passed and businesses were just beginning to get their permit applications in. I remember asking you, is it too late? Have you kind of missed the boat on this? But what would you say to that same question now? If folks aren't in it now, do the same challenges exist then as they do now, or have things changed enough to sort of have lowered some of those barriers to entry?
I would say that there really hasn't been any lowering of barriers to entry, and several things I would point out right off the bat. One, you know, at this point, AMCO is flooded, so, you know, the licensing process is taking longer and longer as we move forward. New applicants are looking at a longer time frame. That shouldn't alone discourage people. I will say, if you really want to do this, and you're the type of person that will not quit and will not give up, you should still give it a shot. If it's that you're looking for a business that's going to make you wealthy pretty quickly and that's relatively stable, then stay away from this. I also will point out that a lot of people are talking about a second wave at this point. And what they mean by that is that the second wave of applicants are at a disadvantage to everybody that's already established. Still, that shouldn't scare somebody away who's really passionate about doing this. I would also advise that no one open a retail right now, unless you're also applying for a grow. That's just my personal advice.
And why do you think those two things work best together? Maybe it looks like you have some opinions on this, Patricia, as the owner of a retail establishment. Yeah.
Well, retail, of course, is based on population base. Down here in the Kenai Peninsula, we really are a very low population base. We only are able to, support so many people who are interested in purchasing. I feel like we've kind of reached, we're about five or six retail stores. I want to say 2 years ago when we were talking to the borough, I had predicted that five or six would be about where we hit and who could sustain. Anybody else is not going to be able to make enough. There are quite a few extra costs involved in running a retail store on a federal income tax level, and that affect retail differently than any other marijuana business. So our income tax base is twice as much as an average store. So you have some costs involved, which means you need multiple sales in order to help some of those extra costs. I think you're right. I think we're at a spot right now for retail that I don't think we could support more stores.
Yeah.
And also there, with the amount of stores that there are and the lack of cultivators, there's been a really big lack of product available. Stores have been having to close their doors involuntarily just because they have nothing to sell.
Yeah, I know that was a problem around the first of the year. It seemed like everybody was all geared up for the holidays, and then it was really tough because not only was the supply low, but the rest of that process, getting it tested and all that stuff, was sort of lagging behind demand.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to have turned around.
It's getting there. As you know, more cultivators are being approved and getting to where they're able to operate, getting more product out there. I think that's been changing quite a bit lately.
Yeah, the supply and demand is definitely starting to even out, because every month there's another cultivator that comes on. But definitely when we first opened, we closed for 3 weeks in February just for lack of supply.
Yeah, it's tough. And Leaf, I want to point this towards you, because you supply doesn't come just from the Kenai Peninsula for stores on the Kenai Peninsula, although just about, I imagine, every grower on the Kenai Peninsula is represented in just about every store, but your product also goes out to other places across the state. And what's demand like in other parts of the state, Leaf?
Well, demand has been extremely high. You know, we've been unable to supply everyone who wants us to supply them. We work with 20 different retailers right now, and a lot more than that have asked. We have waiting lists through November right now for product. So new retailers signing on with us at this point have to wait until then. It's interesting that, I mean, as far as supply and demand goes, we have a lot of farms down here. So I think that, you know, the Kenai Peninsula will probably produce more than it will consume if the farmers know what they're doing. So you should see a lot of it, just like with our farm, a lot of it going to other places in the state. You know, we serve Fairbanks, we serve Sitka, soon to be serving Ketchikan and Juneau. We serve Valdez, we serve Anchorage. And I'm not sure, I know some of the products are coming back this way. I don't know if any of the flower is, but I know that concentrates from, you know, other parts of the state are coming to the stores here, edibles, that sort of thing. So it's definitely, you know, a statewide industry and a statewide network, especially for the cultivators and the manufacturers.
And I'm glad you mentioned concentrates and some other products. You know, we began the program talking about the idea that there are a lot of tourists and a lot of folks who had maybe never visited a retail marijuana store before. And Patricia, you kind of talked a little bit about what that was like for them and for you as well. And you know, I'm no stranger to certain aspects of the cannabis culture myself, but some of these things I really don't know anything about. And it's, you know, concentrates and dabs and waxes. And I guess for anyone who wants to jump on it, maybe could we break down a little bit what some of these different things are for folks who maybe don't know and aren't totally hip to the jive on everything?
So concentrates is basically you're taking your marijuana flower. There's little glands on the flower called trichomes, and it's kind of a sappy substance. That's where all your cannabinoids are, your tetrahydrocannabinol, cannabidiol, all of the other cannabinoids in the plant. So when it's being processed and concentrated, you're basically stripping these glands and all the molecules in them out of the leaf. So now you have a leaf-free product. It can be refined into many, many different products. There's different oils and waxes, different percentages. You know, different plants will yield more or less. Different plants will yield a higher THC percentage, for instance, or a CBD percentage, for instance. So these are being used in a variety of ways. Dabs is more of the big sticky, kind of like a glob, I would say. It looks like honey, and that's either put on flour, or there's different devices that people use to vaporize it, which vaporizing is nice because there's no combustion of a plant material. So there's no ash or anything of that nature. So there's different ways to use it. People also use it in different foods and edibles, and especially for the medical community that is wanting to use cannabis for their purposes. They tend to choose to ingest that in a lot of different ways, or body salves for aching joints, that sort of thing.
And that was, you mentioned edibles. Where are we? I know the state of Alaska has slightly different rules. There are products available in Colorado or Washington, and some of those things aren't necessarily available here yet for different reasons. But in terms of edibles, which are available here, I believe, right? Maybe you could, Patricia, you could talk a little bit about edibles, because I know that for folks maybe who want to experiment a little bit, that's a totally different experience, as I understand it.
Well, we sell out edibles. The state of Alaska, I believe it went by legislation, but there was some fear in having THC in edibles. That was probably 2 years ago after AS 1738 passed. That was the biggest concerns you heard is how do you keep edibles like cookies and brownies and all these things out of children's hands. That was a very big concern. So the compromise given was that there would, in the state of Alaska, our edibles never have more than 5 milligrams of THC in each serving. That's actually relatively low. A regular user would need to eat quite a few edibles. So basically, if you really wanted to eat a brownie and experience a real high to it, you got to make them yourself. And that's just really what it comes down to. It was a compromise, but it is a safety issue, and I think it was a fair compromise. It's been nice because especially in the tourism market where we sell a lot of edibles, there's a lot less fear of, oh, if I eat too much of it, if I'm out fishing, and am I going to, get too high, because they are very low THC. Now you can have higher CBDs in edibles, which is, what a lot of people like are the high CBDs, but that doesn't make you high. That helps with all some other things.
I was going to say the CBD, the strands and the kinds of marijuana that are higher in the CBD numbers, those are the ones that, again, that as I understand it, give you less of the sort of psychological thing and are more of the medicinal strains, correct?
Yes. So cannabidiol is actually tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, is the only psychoactive component, THC and THCV and cannabis. So cannabidiol and all the other components are non-psychoactive. And cannabidiol is the one that most people go for when they don't want to get high. They just want to use it for their own personal purposes, whether that be medical or otherwise. I know I've used cannabidiol, and for me, it gives me just a very calming, relaxing feeling with a very clear mind. And so I think that's a misconception people have, is marijuana gets you high. That is not true. Not all marijuana does get you high, and that's not always the intent of marijuana.
A question that I got, and Dolly Phelps, we just heard from co-owns Peace Frog Botanicals up in Nikiski. We're also joined this morning with Patricia Patterson. She runs High Bush Buds over by Soldotna and Leaf Abel in the studio this morning as well, from Greatland Ganja down in Kasilof. And one of the questions that I got this morning before the program, some of the names of these products, well, frankly, we can't say all the names. Some of Alaska's most famous strains, I don't believe we can name on the radio, but Leaf, where do you come up with the names for these different strains? Is there a certain level of inspiration that goes into that, or?
The breeders come up with the names.
Okay.
So with only one exception, we use the name that the actual breeders use.
Okay.
We feel that educates the consumer the best. They're going to know what they're buying the best, because, that's a standard across. It's like, okay, I'm buying romaine lettuce at Safeway. Well, over here at Fred Meyer's, I'm buying romaine lettuce too. Might be a slightly different phenotype, might be a different farmer, but at least I know somewhat how that's going to behave in my salad. So we look at it like that. There is one exception to that, and we make it very clear. Sometimes when we sprout a couple different phenotypes, say in this case it was Jack the Ripper from TGA Genetics, Subcool Genetics. They do a very good job. They've bred a lot of really top strains. We sprouted the Jack the Ripper, and we ended up with two phenoms that were way different from each other, but they were both keepers. So we named one, Jack the Ripper 1 and Jack the Ripper 3. Once you hit the market with that, you don't want to confuse customers. So we named one of them Space Rip and said, hey, this is, a specialty phenotype of Jack the Ripper. It's Space Rip, and it's, more likened back to its Space Queen parent root. That's how we handle it. Once we do breeding, which we need to expand our facility to accommodate that, we do have some very creative people, and coming up with some names will be fun. Oftentimes, I think with cannabis naming, you try to come up with a name that will somehow educate or describe its effect to the consumer, and then it's oftentimes should be memorable and playful.
Yeah, that's an interesting marketing aspect that for so many years, it's kind of tongue in cheek what we call some of these things, and it's very there's a lot of cultural culture attached to it, but now it's becoming sort of a marketing exercise, and a lot of thought needs to go into to what you name this stuff, I have to imagine. Tune to the Kenai conversation this morning here on KDLL 91.9 FM. Kenai Soldotna, we're talking about the cannabis industry on the Kenai Peninsula. No shortage of things to talk about if you would like to get in on the conversation. 690-1687 is the number. And as we get to the bottom of the hour, I think I need a little bit more coffee. We're going to take a quick break and be back here in just a few moments. Again, tune to the Kenai conversation this morning. Stay with us. And thanks for sticking with us again. Tune to the Kenai Conversation this morning on KDLL. I'm Shaylin Cochran. We've been talking all about the Kenai Peninsula's relatively new cannabis industry this morning. If you would like to get in on the conversation, 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687. If you'd like to do a little pot talk this morning. We've been chatting this morning with Leif Abel. He helps run Greatland Ganja down in Kasiloff. Dolly Phelps also with us from Peace Frog Botanicals up in Nikiski. And Patricia Patterson from High Bush Buds over by Soldotna. And the phone is going right now. Let's see if we can bring a caller up. Good morning. Who's this?
This is Sally Cassano. Good morning, Shaylin Cochran.
Good morning, Sally. How are you?
Excellent. You've got a great panel on this morning. What a good show. I just had a comment and then a question that I'll, of course, take my answer off the air. But that is, first of all the time when we go to something new in our communities or even in our country, once we start, once people's perspectives start being sprinkled with facts and logic and experience, they're bound to change. And I think we're seeing that a lot here on the Kenai Peninsula regarding marijuana and sales of. My question about that is, how is the banking process going for our new stores here on the peninsula? And I'll just take that off the air, if you don't mind.
No problem. Thank you for that call, Sally. And that is a huge question, and it's a question that, not just people are dealing with in Alaska, but all over, because there's a huge sort of discrepancy in between this business and every other business that exists. And everybody's kind of pointing to you, Patricia, so I'll let you take that.
Banking has been very, very difficult. We cannot bank. We are unable to put any money that is generated in our business in a bank. The banks in there are some banks in Colorado that have taken on the marijuana industry. They have their numbers are bigger, so you have to look at risk and reward. And right now, the banks in Alaska have decided the reward is not worth the risk because we are all small. We're really not a huge, there's not a huge amount of money right now. There's, 115 licenses, 130 licenses statewide. So we all work in cash. In fact, I say that people say, well, what do you do with all that cash? And I said, well, actually, by the time you pay all your bills, you're not working in that much cash. We are all the first year out of the gate. Yeah. So there's not, this is not the most profitable time for anybody who starts a business. I'm hoping Don Young actually is spearheading to make it easier for banks to have less liability within the legal marijuana community. But it is a problem.
Yeah, Representative Young has been on this issue as sort of a states' rights issue and in trying to clear some of those roadblocks. Do you see other efforts like that being made, be it at the state level, at the federal level, that more and more folks that are able to make those decisions and develop those policies have an open ear? I'll just throw that out to anyone.
There's been multiple bills in both of the last sessions on the national level put forth to fix this issue. The single biggest fix for this is to just deschedule cannabis, and Congress needs to do that. Everything else is a workaround, and this descheduling will fix a lot of issues related to this plant.
Something that has struck me, because I mean, obviously when this was pitched and when folks voted on it, the idea was that we were going to bring a lot of regulation to this. It was going to make things safer. Part of that, of course, is warning labels and letting folks know that marijuana is indeed an intoxicating substance and there are things to be aware of. What I found kind of confusing is that the warning label is there, but yet so many studies are inconclusive. It's very difficult to study the effects of marijuana because of that, as you mentioned, of its federal status as a controlled substance, Schedule I substance. It's really tough. I know that the marijuana that's used at the federal level for testing is not particularly good and certainly not what's available just on the open market in legal markets now. And that has to be, is that a thorn in the side? Is that kind of aggravating to see the federal government a little bit behind the ball on these things, that the states are moving so far forward?
Absolutely. And it's difficult even within our state because we know so much scientifically about cannabis now. And this is from my personal perspective, a lot of those warnings are maybe not very accurate, but we're forced to put them on there anyway. You know, it's state regulation. We're required to do that, and we will, you know, so we can remain compliant. But I think that has to change. I think at some point we have to acknowledge the facts about cannabis. I mean, there's so much scientific research. It's documented and everywhere. I mean, the Journal of Medicine, National Journal of Drug Abuse. I mean, even these types of places are studying cannabis, and they're all coming up with the same thing. So I'm hoping at some point in time, we can be real with it. At this point, we just got to play ball.
And one of those things in terms of being real, a couple of years ago, the National Transportation Safety Board, I believe it was, began taking up this issue because as more and more states legalize and as marijuana becomes more and more available and out in the public, there are obvious safety concerns when you're giving someone intoxicating substances and legal access to them. Public safety becomes a major issue. But what's been interesting is that there haven't been a ton of studies, but there was a very popular one, a big one that made a lot of headlines that suggested, well, in terms of those intoxicating substances, essentially you could do a lot worse than marijuana. And I'm curious, is that part of the conversation when you run into people who are not maybe quite as friendly to the industry? Do you throw facts at them? Do you throw studies at them? What is the conversation like when you're trying to, I guess, sort of normalize this? Because it is a shock to a lot of people. It's something that was below the radar for so long. Is it becoming easier to talk about it with folks who maybe don't always agree with you? And how do you do that?
Absolutely. And for me, I bring the casual conversation up everywhere I go. I do most likely always have my little fact book with me with random facts. But really, I do my research and I try to bring that out into the public or out into whether I'm doing a presentation or just a meet and greet. And then just the knowledge that I have, I share with, you know, people in everyday conversation. And a lot of people don't care. They hold the blind eye. They hold their hands over the eyes. They don't want to see the facts, even though they're there. And I think that's our struggle. It's just been stigmatized for so long. For some people, it's beyond change.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a generational thing at this point. It'll just, like so many things, it'll just take time. Again, tune into the Kenai Conversation this morning here on KDLL. Dolly Phelps with us from Peace Frog Botanicals in Nikiski. Patricia Patterson joining us as well. She runs High Bush Buds over by Soldotna, and Leif Abel with us in the studio this morning as well from Greatland Ganja down in Kisilov, talking all about the Kenai cannabis industry and how things are going with that. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, questions, concerns, comments, 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687. And a little bit earlier, Dolly gave us a bit of a snapshot, and the numbers are still pretty new. I mean, businesses haven't been around for that long, but we're beginning to get some sense of the economic impact of this new industry here locally. And I was hoping maybe you could kind of run us through, because I know that these dollars circulate locally, and we hear that not just in the marijuana industry, but in other industries as well, that those dollars generated by this business or that business tend to multiply locally. And maybe you could kind of walk us through the path of a dollar or a big bag of dollars. From sort of seed to final product. How does that work? Who gets affected by this?
All right. Well, it's many, many people. We call them the ancillary businesses or businesses that are not necessarily in the industry but supportive of the industry. My dollar would start with the cultivation of marijuana. I would sell my product then to a retailer. I have currently one employee that we've hired since we're a small mom and pop shop, so to speak. He's got a family and children that he supports on his wages from us. Money circulates to the retailer. She then has other people that she's paying for the money she's generating for her employees. We buy lots of garden supplies. We pay our security system people. We pay, let's see, what else? All sorts of stuff. it gets... Go ahead, Lee.
Electric bill.
Oh, yeah.
The electric bill, absolutely. I mean, it's really it's just like any other business, you know. So it goes off into the community in so many different ways. It's hard to keep track of every person that paid wages from this industry is then caring for themselves and their family, buying products within the community, paying their bills, buying new cars and that sort of thing. I know I recently bought a new vehicle, and I did use my recently earned marijuana money, and I walked in with lots and lots of 20s to the car dealership. And to me, that was a perfect example of a good substantial amount of money that I've earned that's going directly into a local business.
I think we have to also look at the employees, and it's something that we don't always talk about. Within a black market community, we have nothing for people who work in that. So I have 8 employees, 2 part-time, 6 are full-time, unemployment insurance. They all have the ability to lose their job and still pay their rent. Workman's comp. Every single person in legal marijuana has the cushion to get injured at work and not have it devastate his family. Child support. I have 3 employees that we take out for child support. Let's look at the protection and your rights. If my employee works 8 hours, they get so much an hour. When they work more than 8 hours, they get time and a half. That is so important within these 100 jobs that we've created in the peninsula, because now they take they're out there and because they're working within a legal market, they can rent homes, they can buy cars on credit, they can, once that money is in the light instead of being in the dark, and they actually have rights. I look at it from an employer's point of view with just unemployment insurance. That's more money going into the coffer, which helps everybody's rating. You know, so I think that from an employee standpoint, allowing those who work within the marijuana community, it's essential that it's a legal regulated business and not put back in the backyard in the dark and in the black market again.
And that's talking about that. I remember, you know, going back to when all this was getting off the ground, there were, you know, a lot of concerns about just how this industry would take shape. And one of the concerns was, you know, the idea that pot was going to be growing sort of everywhere and you'd be able to see it. But just a couple of weeks ago, I remember your testimony at a borough assembly meeting, Leave, talking a little bit about the cultivation facilities and some of the security demands that are placed on those. And I was hoping you could talk just a little bit briefly about what a cultivation facility is like, what some of those rules are like, what you have to provide in terms of security and access. I noticed you've got a nice Greatland Ganja name tag. Looks very official. Talk a little bit about that. And if that's kind of a barrier to keeping to making it easier, and if that's all necessary, or what are your thoughts on it?
Well, the security, I think, is an important component of the regulations for several reasons. One, we do have a high dollar product, and you know the value of that product may over time decrease and even out, and it will, but it's always going to be somewhat high value. So not unlike, you know, a bank or someone else, we, you know, have to take measures to protect it. Also, it's important that there be strong security regulations right now so that the state can prove to the federal government that they're meeting the 8 points laid out in the Cole Memorandum, which is what keeps all of us safe here in the state system. So for those reasons, I support most of the security measures. I think they are somewhat long-term, they're somewhat over the top, and maybe we can change some of them a little bit. But, you know, as an outdoor cultivator, as a greenhouse cultivator in polyfilm greenhouses, we have, a fence line that is secured. It's privacy fencing. You can't see through it. It has alarms around it. All the gates are alarmed. Then furthermore, once you get inside, the greenhouses are alarmed. The hydro building's alarmed. There's basically every square foot of the facility is monitored by cameras, and then 40 days of that footage is saved in multiple locations. So it's, it's pretty hard for anything to get done there that isn't seen, monitored, known, which it actually is really handy for a business owner and just for keeping track of everything from, hey, when did the delivery guy show up the other day? Or, when did the concrete pour start on the new greenhouse? If there's a question that a regulator has, they can come in and we can pull the footage and look at that exact timestamp for them. In addition, we have to report and ID everybody who comes onto the premise and log that in our visitor logs. Once again, this can be, this time frame that they were on that premise can then be looked back on the footage for that timestamp. And this is just kind of, breaking the surface. I could go into metric and all the tracking systems that we use for our product, and then all of our operating procedures. But, you know, suffice it to say that I've been told by both of the security companies that serve us that we have a higher requirement both for transporting and protecting on premise than the folks that are dealing with radioactive waste or explosives.
That's interesting. And for folks who are worried about the safety and security, I hope maybe that gives a little bit of confidence there. And you mentioned visitors being allowed. Are there tours? Is this going to be like Sonoma Valley? Are we going to be doing marijuana tours and samples? Is that something that's going to be coming down the pike? Do you have tours?
We do have tours. At this point, we do tours mostly for public relations and for people that are interested in seeing what a business like this looks like in their community. We give lots of tours to fire marshals, fire departments. They do walkthroughs to see what it might look like to respond to a facility like this. We give tours to, you know, the mayor, their staff, the planning commission, the locals in the area. So far, we have yet to start a program where we're charging for tours. That's certainly what happens down in Washington, Colorado. They're charging for the tours. Nice little ancillary part of it. I would foresee in the future probably doing that as extra tourism revenue.
That's interesting. And again, it's something that's come up before, is the potential for the cannabis industry to kind of spider web off of itself and offer these other things. Well, as we get down into the last little bit of the program here, 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Patricia Patterson joining us this morning. She runs High Bush Buds over by Soldotna. Dolly Phelps with us as well from Peace Frog Botanicals in Nikiski, and Leif Abel, whom we just heard from with Greatland Ganja down in Kasiloff. And I would be remiss if we didn't take at least a couple of minutes here to close out the program. Coming up this fall on the ballot is it Proposition 1?
Proposition 1.
And well, before we get into talking about that, we will go to the phones here. And good morning. Welcome to the conversation. Who's this?
Hello. My name's Holly, and I really appreciate this discussion because I've been thinking about how I'm going to vote. This has been the most educational one I've heard so far. I want you to know I really do appreciate the fact that there is tax revenue and it's no black market. And I do certainly, I think a lot of Alaskans do think what you do in your own home's your own thing, or, you know, that's okay. Now, I want you to understand why I'm probably going to vote. I don't know which way the proposition's phrased, but I'm probably going to vote against it, and this is why. It is the edibles. When you talked about the concentration level for the DAPs and such, to me that's equivalent like just having, you know, drinking a bottle of 100 proof. It kind of takes that argument away that, you know, marijuana is less dangerous than alcohol. So I'm having a tough time wrapping my mind around having such looped visitors to the peninsula, you know, driving their cars or doing whatever they're going to do. But the other thing is, and I know of two personal cases, I don't like to do gossip, but I personally know of two cases where the edibles have gotten into the high schools, and there have, you know, a person who took them was unaware. So truly, if you took away the edibles, I mean, I probably could get around the DAP thing because that's harder to do. But if the edibles were gone, then I would vote for this. So I just want you to understand someone like me, and I'll listen to the answer off the air. Thank you very much for the program.
You're very welcome, Holly, and thank you so much for that call. And Dolly, I'll throw it in your direction. The concern there being not necessarily marijuana itself, but the way it's available. And again, kind of getting back to this idea that it's not your dad's pot, that kind of thing.
Sure. I think the first thing I would like to point out is this vote that would ban all marijuana facilities in the Kenai Peninsula borough, but only outside of city limits, will not get rid of marijuana or edibles. All it will do is get rid of the 34 new businesses and the jobs and the revenue that we've seen. But because marijuana is available, it's still going to be legal here. Every single person who lives on the peninsula can grow marijuana. What we're trying to do is regulate it. With regulation comes safety. So when you have a 5 milligram THC edible, typically, and I will be quite frank here, for any cannabis user, for an edible to have any effect on them, it's going to have to be 30 to 50 milligrams. So the reason why those edibles were created at 5 milligram instead of 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 is because if somebody is irresponsible, and maybe they leave their bottle of alcohol on the counter, maybe not, but maybe they did leave a brownie on the counter. The point is that 5 milligram brownie is so low that it will not negatively hurt anyone's child. I think that's the biggest misconception people have, is with this regulation and these regulated business comes the control that we all seek. I'm a mother myself. I care about my kids and all my neighborhood kids as well. I don't want to see this in their hands. Legal stores aren't where they're getting it. They're getting it from the black market. And it's a little sad to see, because the black market folks who want to continue to stay black market and sell to minors will be voting no on proposition as well as the people that want to put us out of business. So I think that's part that they're not quite getting yet, is this is the protection they're seeking.
Yeah, and I wanted to, I'll throw this out to either Patricia or you as well, Leif, and thanks for following up on that, Dolly. I have to imagine that you hear concerns as well, and are they those same kinds of concerns, like this product is too much, we're unsure of what it will do, we're unsure of the effect that it will have, be it with kids having access or with people driving? Are these concerns that you hear often, or...
I would have. I actually wish the caller would have stayed on the line for a minute. My first question would have been: Were these labeled packaged edibles from a retail store? Likely, they might not have been. I have yet to have heard one single case where those have ended up in the hands of a kid in the school. Most of the edibles that I see right now are made by people on the unregulated market, or even just at home, and that's. It's within everybody's right, but people should be careful at home too, I guess, is what I'm getting around to. At home, when I cook my edibles for my medical use, I label them. I treat them like they are, a pharmaceutical or alcohol. We don't want our kids opening our bottles of pharmaceuticals either. And we don't want them to drink legal alcohol either. So you just have to, once again, you protect your firearms too. These are things that adults have to do in a responsible society. I would also like to point out we do get a lot of these types of questions. And a lot of them are based on the fact that people don't understand what cannabis actually does to you. It does not intoxicate you like alcohol. It does not have the effect that, say, meth or heroin or some other drug might have on you. It is a separate plant that does something entirely different. It might, according to some people, have some mind-altering effects. Once again, we need to actually get some scientists to tell us what that means and what is actually going on. Right now, that hasn't been allowed. But it definitely does not affect people like alcohol, and I think that, that is why continuing to get out there, all three of us and everybody else who is involved, and educating, to make sure that people understand why we need to vote no on Prop 1, why we need to keep legal cannabis businesses in the peninsula, so that the cannabis that's being sold is regulated and we know that it's tested and that the Kenai Peninsula Borough has local control over it.
And just to, we've got just about a minute left here, and Dolly or Patricia, whoever would like to kind of wrap up for us, just looking ahead to this vote so we can touch on it right at the end, what would you like folks to think about as they address this question this fall?
Well, the biggest thing is this has nothing to do with whether or not you want to make marijuana illegal. Marijuana, AS 1738, which is the law that legalized marijuana, that's here. Everyone has the right to grow up to 6 plants in their living room. Everyone has the right to make or smoke anything they want. That does not go away. The only thing this vote does is say, do you want to put it back into the black market hands, or do you want to keep it as a legal business here on the peninsula? So I think the biggest thing I would ask people when they look at the vote is try to look at it from a business standpoint, because marijuana is not going to go away. I mean, it's here. It's always been here. We're just trying to keep it safe, clean, tested, and regulated and controlled.
And I think that is the perfect note to end on. And I want to thank Patricia Patterson. Thank you so much for being here. Dolly Phelps, Leif Abel, thank you all so much for your time this morning. It's a great program. I learned a lot. And I want to thank all of our callers as well. Thanks so much, guys, for being in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you as well for tuning in this morning. Again, thanks to our callers who called in with some great questions this morning. This has been the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. If you missed any portion of the show, we'll have it up on our website, kdll.org, a little bit later today. I'm Shaylin Cochran. Have a great morning.